This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The bottom line is, you know, without the positive reinforcement, without the, you know, incentives to do so, I don't think that we can depend on people to take the right action. And it's not that they don't want to. It's just that they're busy and there's lots of other things they could be doing with their time.
This week on Sea Change Radio, we talked to game theory expert Gabe Zickerman about how gamification, a concept of using fun, engaging challenges to encourage certain behavior, can play a larger role in the sustainability movement. While gamification has recently risen in popularity in the business world, particularly in online marketing, Zickerman discusses how gamifying more parts of our daily routine can play a role in helping craft better policy, and how gamification can encourage individuals to consciously and sometimes subconsciously help themselves and the environment. My guest today on Sea Change Radio is Gabe Zickerman. He's the CEO of Gamification Co. and the chair of the Gamification Summit. Gabe, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex.
In layman's terms, what is gamification?
Well, gamification is the process of using game thinking and game mechanics to engage audiences and solve problems. And there's a few key takeaways from that. You know, another simple way to think about it is taking any the lessons of the games industry, you know, which has been very, you know, informative and influential over the last 30 years, and particularly lessons from social games like Farmville on Facebook, and taking those and applying them to non-game contexts. And broadly speaking, at the Gamification Summit and in my books and, you know, in my lectures and research, we focus on two kinds of applications, and that's why I divided them into engaging audiences, which is, you know, probably the biggest category, getting people to engage with the product, service, or idea, and solving problems. Because some of our most intractable problems in the world, we've basically run up against what you can think of as the last possible option. That is to say, if gamification doesn't help with some of these issues, we're not sure what will.
Gabe, how do you think gamification can play a role in improving sustainability efforts and other more intractable environmental problems?
Well, at the core of what we do in gamified design is we unpack user motivations and try to understand what drives the user and what are they aspiring to. And then we take that aspiration, what we call progression to mastery, and I'll explain that more in a minute. We take that aspiration and we break that down into a system that a user can follow, that they find fun and engaging, that gets them through the process of mastering whatever it is that they're trying to accomplish. The core concept of progression to mastery is that people have all these challenges in their lives. They have all these mountains they're trying to climb at any one time. Their weight, their finances, their career, the environment, their children's education, their love life, what have. And we are all trying to master these processes in our life. And the best gamified systems, or the best games for that matter, turn that into a structured process that a user can follow. So they go through that. And at the end, they've actually mastered this thing. Whether that's the core system of the game, so if it's a purely entertainment experience, or in a gamified system, something in the world around them in general, something nonfiction, right? So I believe, and I think most of the people in the gamification industry believe, that fundamentally people aspire to shape the world in an image of, you know, beauty and grace and efficiency, let's say. Not that those things are mutually exclusive. And so we want the world to be a greener, better place. We want it to be cleaner. We want to use less energy. But for most people, it's so abstract. The process of getting from where they are today to an outcome that is more energy efficient, that's more green, that's more sustainable, is super abstract. There are too many steps for them to follow. So one of the core tenets of gamification, one of the things that it does better than just about any other system in the world, is break that down into easy steps that people can follow. They get rewarded as they pass through those steps. And at the end, hopefully, if the system is well designed, users kind of look back and say, oh my God, I just did that. I just, you know, cut down my consumption. I kept my, you know, I kept my footprint smaller. So it's about getting people from A to B, where A is where they're at today, and B is where they aspire to be. And I think it's a sort of, it sounds very, you know, abstract and kind of maybe a little bit romantic, but it's actually at the heart of what we do when we design any gamified experience. It's exactly like that.
Tell about the speed camera lottery in Sweden.
So Kevin Richardson, who's actually San Francisco-based game designer, designed this concept called the speed camera lottery, which is an amazing idea and highlights one of the core strengths of gamification, which is turning some of the basic ideas in our world on their head in a way that's immediately meaningful and makes sense. So the basic concept is, you know, those speed cameras that take your picture. They're not very common here in California, but they're very common in Europe. And one of the core things about those speed cameras in Sweden is the ticket that you get is based on your income level. It's not based on how fast you're going, but the more money you make, the more expensive the ticket. So tickets can be quite big, depending on how much money you make.
I can see Republicans in America just loving this concept.
Yeah, that would be probably problematic. Explode, yes. Even though technically that qualifies as a progressive penalty, but I digress. So in the speed camera model, you know, you drive by and you get this big penalty depending on how much money you make. So what Kevin proposed, which they actually implemented in Sweden in a test bed, was very simple. Instead of just penalizing people who exceed the speed limit, why not enter everybody who drives under the speed limit into a lottery to split the winnings of the people who speed? And the effect in the speed camera lottery was shocking. In the first week, it had like a 22 or 23% reduction in speeding past the point. And this is without education. There's no pedagogy. People haven't received a leaflet in their mail. They don't really understand how it works other than a big sign, which gives them a thumbs up or thumbs down and says speeding lottery. So 22% reduction in speeding, or even for that matter, a 10% reduction in speeding, you know, would mean tens of thousands of people's lives saved in the United States. I mean, we're not talking about needing to reduce speeding by 90% in order to have a substantial effect. These numbers are already meaningful. And it highlights one of the key things about how game designers think differently about the world from most other people. It's not about punishment. Punishment does not work as an effective long-term behavior change strategy. Punishments are important in many ways, but large, outsized, abstract punishments don't work as well as well-structured rewards. And that's the core premise.
And gamification seems to have been making some strides in places you may not expect to see it, like in the car industry.
In auto in general, in the automotive category in general, there are many sort of advanced things happening with gamification that are kind of shocking, because you don't generally think about that category as being very evolutionary, right? I mean, we more or less have the same set of technologies that we've had for about 100 years and more or less are dealing with the same kinds of problems we've been dealing with for at least 70 of those 100 years. So it doesn't seem like the auto category would be super innovative. But one of the bright spots in auto innovation actually has been in-dash economy driving games, which have become sort of de rigueur among hybrid car manufacturers. It started with the Prius and now has evolved to a socially networked game that's actually in the Nissan Leaf. And basically the premise is built into the dashboard of the car gives you what you would think of as biofeedback if it was attached to your arm, but it's actually a type of feedback game mechanism that gives you visual feedback about how ecologically effectively you're driving. So that is to say, if you stay within a particular band of, you know, consumption in terms of miles per gallon, you grow a tree where additional leaves pop up on your screen. And eventually the games are actually even designed to give you a progressive challenge. So that is to say, as you continue to drive, the games challenge you to drive more and more efficiently. So even if you start out, you know, being super efficient, the game keeps asking you to drive more and more efficiently. The importance of this shouldn't be understated in terms of changing user behavior. It costs hundreds of millions of dollars for those car manufacturers to tool up to put those games into the dashboard. It's a substantial statement about where they see interactivity around ecology going, that on one hand, they simply empower you by putting in complicated hybrid technology to use less miles per gallon, but then they try to reinforce the good behavior, which you still as a user, so you still need to plug in some user behavior changes. So they try to reinforce that good behavior using a game mechanic, because game mechanics are more powerful at doing that than other techniques.
Thank you. To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and my guest is gamification expert Gabe Zickerman. So on your site, gamification.co, I saw there was a video, a presentation, and you mentioned how the house always wins.
Yes.
And that sounds like a problem when you're considering a state lottery or a Vegas casino, but it can be a positive thing when used judiciously in an area such as sustainability, right?
100%. In fact, it's core to the... It's the sort of rallying cry that I use to get people to think about using game techniques in their particular business or their, you know, efforts to create a more sustainable world. You know, it's really this idea that if you take the position of being the designer of the experience, you have the benefit of driving, you know, the right kind of behavior, driving the behavior that you're looking for. So I think it's about not being passive actors in people's intrinsic game, in the dance, you know, the drama that people are playing out intrinsically all the time, that we hope we're going to grab just a little bit of their time and energy so that they'll, you know, come and do something good or focus a little bit of attention on doing better in the world. You know, instead of doing that, we need to design for that. If we want people to take better action, we want them to drive less, we want them to drive more efficiently, we need to design for that. Penalties alone don't work. And depending on their intrinsic motivation alone no longer works. We have to design for it.
Tell us about how virtual economies have been applied in your hometown of Toronto in the waste management field.
Well, you know, Toronto and San Francisco both have been pretty advanced in the subject of dealing with trash. And so one of the most interesting things, and I observed this and then became interested in it going home and visiting my parents who, you know, I grew up in Toronto and I lived there. And, you know, Toronto was early to the composting in every home, big recycling options, and trash. So the three bins thing has been around in Toronto for a long time. But Toronto decided that they didn't want to send any trash to the landfill, ideally, if they could avoid it. So the first thing they did was, after implementing the three bins, was they made almost everything recyclable. So they decided, well, we'll just up the recycling quotient in Toronto trash so that, you know, we'll deal with that in the back end. And that's sort of, if you think about behavior change, that's the, like, classic systems view of it from the infrastructure system. Like when you say the system, that's the classic infrastructure view. Well, let's eliminate the friction to recycling. Let's make everything recyclable and people will recycle more. And that's true because that's a fundamental kind of economic truism. But it doesn't actually change people's behavior, their attachment to the recycling behavior. All it does is removes a roadblock, which I agree should be removed. But it doesn't actually train people on why recycling is important. So the next thing that Toronto did after that was it sized down all of the trash bins. It kept the cost of incremental trash. So it cost a lot of money to put out an extra bag of trash in Toronto. It always cost a lot of money today. I think it's like $100 or something like that. I don't know the actual number off the top of my head, but it's expensive to put an extra bag of trash out on the sidewalk. So what Toronto did was they didn't raise the fine for an extra bag of trash. They didn't increase it. And they didn't decrease trash pickup or anything like that. All they did was make the bin smaller for trash. They made it, I think it was 10 or 12% smaller. Everybody's bins. Didn't matter who you were, what you did. This is a classic game virtual economy strategy. So what they did was there's a certain amount of, I don't want to like bore everybody with the economics of it, but let's put it this way. There's a certain amount of money supply in the market. There's supply in the market. In this case, it's trash bin size. So you have two ways of dealing with users. You could either make trash collection way more expensive, make the penalties way bigger, which would be the old way, or you can just change the size, meaning dial down the economy, inflate it a little bit, let's say. So now that
tweak the variables.
Yeah, you're basically inflating the economy. You're making that same bin of trash basically smaller. And By doing so, you're actually subtly training users that they have to throw out less trash in the black bin. That's it. So the amazing behavior change, I have to tell you, just seeing my mom, you know, she's not, I wouldn't call her high like environmental or sustainability consciousness person. My mom is fastidious about recycling everything. Like she is insane about it now. This is literally in the last 3 or 4 years, you know, and it's not, the pedagogical approach didn't work. You know, the city of screaming. I mean, we're all screaming. We as children even, you know, would scream. Like, we have to do more. We can't, you know, this is terrible. The environment's being ruined. That had no effect on her. You know what had an effect on her? Making her bin 15% smaller.
Is she afraid of the penalty of $100 for an extra bag of trash? Or is it more, there's more to it, do you think?
It's her understanding. It taught her that she could do it, that she could you know, that she could trash less stuff and that that was better for her and that there was no, you know, incremental cost of doing so. And all without her saying, because what you would have expected her to say, knowing my mom, is say, those goddamn trash people, you know, they're like always raising the price. So instead of raising the price, they made, they constricted the supply, which is another strategy.
And it made it feel like it was her idea.
Yes, absolutely. And similarly in games, another kind of design approach of games, which is very important for people looking at sustainability and penalty and reward to understand. In most successful social games, there is a modality where a user can get through the whole game without ever paying any money. So let's take, for example, it's what we call the funnel, right? We'll take, for example, a game like Farmville, you know, which has, you know, at its peak had like 80 million users. So of those 80 million users, 92% of people did not pay anything at all, nothing. And in fact, that's by design. The game is meant to engage as many people as possible at the top end in this idea and not really charge them. But there's a funnel. And there are known triggers inside the experience that cause people to sort of trip over and start paying. And so top Farmville players, people at the bottom of the funnel, can pay as much as $10,000 a month to play a game that you and I might play for free. And we may never pay. And this is a really super important difference in the way that game designers think about economies and especially you know, anything that has economic decisions in it. The user's never forced to pay. But if they want things to run a little bit smoother, if they want there to be less friction, if they don't want to spend their time, they can spend their money. And so that's a sort of critical thing as well that we want to bring to sustainability. I think many of those concepts actually could be expanded into other areas of sustainability and allow people to bank credits for doing one thing that's easy for them to do against activities that are harder for them to do and let them pay to get out of it.
So the founder and CEO of Kiva, the microlender, said that their closest competitor is this social video game maker Zynga, which makes Farmville, which you just discussed. What do you think he meant by saying that Zynga is their closest competitor? Because obviously the people who are loaning money to these recipients are very different from somebody who might be playing a video game. First, though, maybe tell our listeners what Kiva is.
Kiva is a microlending site where you can go and, you know, donate money to various causes and, you know, small causes, individual people, and do it that way. If you've seen Facebook Causes, kind of a similar socially promoted, you know, donation platform. There's a whole bunch of companies kind of in that space crowdsourcing donations of time or money to facilitate, you know, good work. Things are changing in our society in a way that may be imperceptible if you don't see them from a game lens. And there are two kind of big things that are changing that are very important for us to understand. The first one is we have depended on people's intrinsic motivation to do good in most of the areas of do-goodery in our society. And frankly, we can no longer depend on that. We can no longer expect that the world will get better based on people's intrinsic motivation to make the world better on one side, right? That's part of the equation. And that means by definition, we have to incentivize people to do the good thing, the right thing. We have to set up rewarding fund systems to get them to do the right thing. Otherwise, we'll end up kind of where we are right now, let's say, moving sideways. And part two is that when it comes to people's leisure time choices, if you can imagine doing good or making sustainable choices, or even volunteering or donating money to sustainable causes, those are all things that people do in their leisure time. And what Primal Shah, the founder of Kiva, understands very well is that all leisure activities compete with each other for time. And there is no question that games are the best, strongest, most lithe competitor in the Colosseum for people's leisure time. They're optimized, they're finely optimized to extract as much time and energy out of people as possible. They're designed to do that. That's the core premise of a game. But the bottom line is, you know, without the positive reinforcement, without the, you know, incentives to do so, I don't think that we can depend on people to take the right action. And it's not that they don't want to. It's just that they're busy and there's lots of other things they could be doing with their time. And really, this is something difficult for people to understand kind of in the nonprofit sector. Volunteerism is a kind of leisure activity for most people. It is not a required activity to put food on the table. And volunteerism and doing good compete with Farmville for people's time and attention. So your experience, no matter what it is that you do, if you're in the leisure category, not the must do, but the nice to do category, you have to incorporate understandings from the game space in order to And that's gamification in order to make your experience equally engaging. What's this so world coming to? Things just ain't the same. Anytime the hunter gets captured by the game. Oh yeah.
Follow the shift to sustainability with SeaChange Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. My guest is gamification expert Gabe Zickerman. You mentioned solar panels. There are some public utilities that are getting involved in gamification to some degree. Can you expound on those a little bit?
Sure. So there's a couple of areas in which your listeners will probably find interesting. There are a couple of areas in which the ability to gamify an experience for the betterment of society have been gated by a sort of data stream. And the two big ones that you have probably run across or you might be interested in are smart meters on the home energy side, and on the other side, what's called quantified self, or biofeedback mechanisms that we wear that give feedback on how many miles we've walked, how many miles we ran, you know, how much energy we've expended. So these are small technical platforms that have been necessary to drive data that can then be taken by third parties and turned into something more compelling. So the smart meters thing is being met in a lot of cases, and I've seen a number of sort of small startups in particular, you know, working on the problems. There have been lots of like little test experiments where, you know, users have been given a number of game incentives to respond to smart meter data. So whether it's, you know, competing with your neighbors, for example, to see who can consume less energy, you know, over a particular period of time, or simply being given feedback about your energy consumption, which is actually something that most people don't even get in the first place.
Especially with your utility company, having kind of a positive feedback loop is not something you're used to having.
Right. And that's a core element of games. Simple feedback loops that are positive and reinforcing is a core concept of games and gamification. Like, congratulations, you did it, right? You used less energy this June than you did last June. Somebody needs to just say that to you.
But then they're also coming up with more transparency where people are competing against their neighbors. In Sacramento, I believe they're doing a program where there's 35,000 randomly selected customers, and then they're rated on their energy use compared to 100 homes of similar size in their area. And I don't know what the outcome of these things are beyond getting smiley faces. Maybe there's a financial incentive. Are you familiar with this program?
Well, I'm not familiar with the Sacramento program, but I can tell you some design things that, you know, we know right away just from, you know, other fields of inquiry. Mm-hmm. The first thing is that competition isn't always the ultimate design idea. Competition doesn't always make things work better or signal game behavior. To be perfectly honest with you, part of it is there's some misconception about what the best techniques are for gamifying something like energy consumption or sustainability. And competition is something that many people go to right away because that to them is the classic kind of game experience. But we know from data about why people play, and I'll tell you about this in a second, and how they play, we know that competition actually isn't the main driver for 80% of the population. 80% of the population is driven to play games for a desire to socialize with other people. It's about a social interaction rather than a competitive interaction. And so many of these ideas, many of the first designs are more oriented around kind of what you'd think of as the, you know, as the simple version of a gamified experience. Well, let's take some people and have them compete and see who can use the least energy. That game might be fun for a certain demographic, usually a man, by the way, between the ages of 18 and 34. That could be kind of fun for a particular demographic for a while. But at some point, that competitive design loses steam. It doesn't reinforce itself. It's actually the video game business that is the exception, not the rule. Most of the most enduring games in human culture and society are multiplayer. Very, very few games are single player. But the video game business that launched in 1974 with the Atari 2600 is the exception. It was the single player game design that never existed before, that now is being usurped by the massively multiplayer social game. And, you know, we all look at it and we say, oh my God, this is a huge new category called social games. Actually, most games are social. So when we talk about this, we talk about the work of a researcher named Richard Bartle, who was one of the first people to look at why people play games. And he identified four different kinds of players, canonical players: the achiever, the explorer, the socializer, and the killer. And these were his sort of four player types. And, you know, he didn't intend it to be a personality inventory, though I'm working with some researchers at Stanford to turn it into a standard personality test, because it just works in so many ways. But the truth is, the vast majority of people are driven to socialize is the main driver for playing. That's why they play games. And achievers and killers, make up about 10% of the population, and explorers about another 10% of the population, you know, sort of canonically speaking. So we have to, when we design experiences for these people, we want to design, you know, for all of them. But I'll give you an example of something that provides some sustainability benefits and leverages the social interaction a little bit. So Google, the large search giant Google, recently redesigned their travel expense system. So in most companies, if you've ever worked for a big company, the way that your travel expenses normally work is they make you go to a travel agency that, you know, then finds the lowest fare, and then they have all these hotels that are on their plan with a certain price, and you can spend that, and then they've got a per diem for food and drink or whatever, and that's the money that you get to spend. So in that design, there's lots of incentive to cheat and also to maximize the amount of money that you're spent, right? If there's a
if you have $50 a day, you're going
to
spend that.
You're going to spend the 50, right? And if there's a Four Seasons or a Four Points by Sheraton to choose from, you're going to choose the Four Seasons, all things being equal. So what Google decided to do instead was change the model. So what they do is they have fixed amounts for every city and flight prices and certain amounts per day that you can spend overall. Any money that you spend below, so anytime you spend less than the cap on a city pair, Google banks that money for you. And you can do one of three things with the money. You can donate it to charity, you can use it to spend on another trip later on in the year, or you can get half of it back in cash at the end of a year. So Google has basically incentivized you to spend less than the cap. The awesome part about the design, the most important thing about the design and critical for sustainability advocacy, is it got people talking about expenses, which had never happened before.
It was kind of the dirty little secret. It's like everyone just kept it to themselves.
That's exactly right. And now it's employees talking to each other and saying, hey, do you know a pretty cheap place that we could stay at in Pittsburgh that's near the office, because I'd like to save money on this trip going to Pittsburgh. And it's those kinds of small designs like Speed Camera Lottery that socialize various aspects that bring game design ideas into the world at large that can trigger important kinds of behavioral change. They're small when they're taken in these kind of chunks. Oh, it's just Google's employees. Oh, it's just, you know, people driving in Sweden, you know, by a speed camera. But when applied in a broader way, when applied to a bigger population, they get pretty exciting.
Gabe Zickerman is the CEO of Gamification Co. and the chair of the Gamification Summit. Gabe, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
Thanks, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Hanuman, John Lennon, and the Marvelettes. Sea Change Radio is made possible by support from Sungevity Home Solar Specialists and Incredible Adventures, an eco-friendly outdoor travel company. Go to incadventures.com to learn more. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.